Welcome to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility, an ongoing inquiry into American political origins and evolving institutions. The executive director of the Virtual Center is Dr. Bill O'Brien. He's also your host for this continuing conversation. And here he is now, Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Thank you, Agnes, and welcome to a Tuesday edition of the Virtual Center for Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility. Today is the 17th day of July in the year 2018. As I mentioned, it is a Tuesday, and it is a pleasure to be with you on this, our second live broadcast of the week. And I say that as a lead into the fact that there won't be a third one. We're going to have to postpone a live program tomorrow, and instead we'll replace it with a previous program. We kind of have conflicts on both ends, so it was really interesting. We were both telling each other, myself and Agnes, for different reasons that we wouldn't be able to have a program tomorrow at the same time. So fact of the matter is I've got a final exam that I'm giving tomorrow, and I'm doing it by email, and I have it's timed, and I have to get the answers back at a particular time, because I'm not giving this person unlimited time. She's going to have to write 7 essays, and I'm giving her 4 hours to do it. But I can't give her any more than that. It wouldn't be fair to the others. So it's due at 1 o'clock, which is exactly the time that the program would begin on Wednesday. So I was going to postpone anyway, because if the exam doesn't get here at 1 o'clock, I'm going to have to go after it. And I didn't want to wait an extra 2 hours while I did the program and not know until 2 hours after the fact that the exam was late. So that's my reason. So we'll be doing a rebroadcast tomorrow, and I do apologize for that. But it's one of those things that we really can't do anything about. So that would mean that today being Tuesday, that when we finish our program today, we won't have another live program until Monday, which would be 6 days. And the way things are going in Washington, an awful lot can happen in 6 days, let me tell you. We found out yesterday an awful lot can happen in 46 minutes, which was the length of that press conference. And the reactions to it continue to pour in. They're absolutely incredible. They're astounding. But, you know, one is left with the question that always seems to be there all the time: who's going to do, or what can we do about it, or will anybody do anything about it, or whatever? The answer to that remains to be seen. I held a press conference this morning early at the Capitol, and he basically said, you know, some pretty bad things about the president's remarks. But at the same time, he denied the fact that he saw them as treasonous. And I think more than one person has mentioned that. I made the comment. I was watching last night. I was watching the replay of a portion of the press conference between Putin and Trump. And there was an exchange in response to one of the questions, and I made the comment to my wife, who was watching it with me, and I said, "No collusion. That right there is collusion. I mean, we're sitting here, we're watching collusion right now, because Vladimir Putin, in response to a question about whether, in fact, he and members of his staff favored Donald Trump's candidacy over Hillary Clinton's, and whether, in fact, his staff did anything about it." And he admitted, he said, yes, I did. And then he said it was because candidate Trump was saying positive things about reestablishing a more positive relationship with Russia, while Hillary Clinton was promising no such thing. But in other words, he did admit that that he and members of his staff were very, very pro Trump in the election. And we'll get into some of that again, because I think there's so much going on in relationship to it that you can't really let it go without making a comment. On the other hand, so many people are making comments on it that it's almost, you know, it's almost like there's nothing else left to say. It's being replayed over and over and over again. There's a few things that I noted that I wanted to at least bring to your attention. I'm not saying that they're unique with me and that nobody else saw them, but I think they're especially or particularly relevant as well. One other thing I'd like to do today, and I thought I would, following whatever comments we can make about the situation from yesterday's press conference in Helsinki. Sunday, July 15th, was the 39th anniversary of an address given to the nation by President Jimmy Carter, his famous crisis of conscience speech, if you can remember hearing about that. Many people believe that that speech cost him in the election, the election that came a few months later against Ronald Reagan. But the fact of the matter is, Reagan's persona was such that it was going to be very, very difficult under any circumstances for Jimmy Carter to get reelected in 1980. And this address was 1979, so it was July 1979. So the election didn't happen until a year and several months after that. But, you know, given the issues that were going on, the long gasoline lines and the high inflation rates, and I can remember at that time my wife was in real estate in Richmond, Virginia, and interest rates on new homes, on home sales, on new mortgages, were, as I remember, in the teens, in the upper teens, you know, 16-17%, things like that. And of course, she was on commission, and people in real estate couldn't earn a living because houses weren't closing. I mean, nobody could, fewer and fewer people could qualify for a mortgage, because when you tacked on that interest rate to a home mortgage, it raised the monthly premiums or monthly payments so high that a lot of people couldn't qualify. And I can remember it created some very, very serious moral issues, ethical dilemmas, if you will. Because realtors, and she used to tell me about this, that realtors representing the buyer and or the seller, the realtors would cut deals with each other. If you can get your client to sign on the bottom line, I'll give you a third of my commission, my 6%, or whatever, and trying to use that as an incentive so that the realtor representing the buyer would try to put pressure on the buyer to sign. And it created serious issues. My wife was very, very disenchanted because many of the people that she had worked with and really had no reason to doubt them or suspect them or question their integrity in any way were cutting deals and doing things because they were desperate to get a closing or two, because they were not on salary. They were on commission exclusively. And so, therefore, if nothing sold, they had no income. So, and when people are in that kind of a situation, they'll sometimes do things that they wouldn't ordinarily do. So it was a very, very difficult time. I think many of us will realize it. And in the middle of that, President Carter gave this address to the nation on the 15th of July and talked about a crisis of confidence. And I remember the speech But given the fact that Sunday was the 39th anniversary of that speech, I went back and reread it. When I saw references to the fact that Sunday was the anniversary date, I went back and read it. And one of the things that I appreciated, and I wanted to share a little bit of this with you today, is how appropriate Carter's comments are now. It's eerie. As I read it, I almost began to quiver a little bit because I said, oh my, it's almost like he could foresee the future. It's incredible. And of course, Jimmy Carter is still going strong. He's still teaching Sunday school. And I saw a reference to the fact on Sunday that he had offered comments on President Trump and his behavior at NATO and in Brussels and all of that. And of course, this was all a prelude to what was going to happen yesterday during the press conference. But I think former President Carter, has established a record that's going to be difficult to beat for presidents, for retired presidents, and that is to essentially establish a service to mankind after you leave the White House that is extremely more impressive, if not extremely more impressive, than the record as president. I heard a lot of people make the comment that Jimmy Carter's failing as president was he was too good a person. You know, that's interesting. Of course, when you realize that President Carter followed Richard Nixon's resignation and the ascendancy for the completion of his term of Gerald Ford, what the nation was looking for was somebody that had their moral bearings and had their feet on the ground ethically and morally. And Jimmy Carter was the guy. But it takes more than that to lead a nation, and I think there are serious issues about the Carter presidency. But I did want to share a little bit with you on that particular speech. Let me take a moment to invite you to share your thoughts with us if you are so inclined. And feel free to call into the program and come on the air and share not only with me, as much as I would appreciate it, and I encourage you to do it, but I think our other listeners would appreciate it as well, to give them the benefit of your thinking. Because if you have issues or positions that are strong enough that you are willing to pick up the phone and call and express them, then I think you can probably rest assured that they are worth hearing and that there are many other listeners who would appreciate hearing them and would benefit from them. You can do that if you are a user of Skype, if you live on the computer, so to speak, as so many people do today. If you go to Skype and type in Bob Kincaid Horn, H-O-R-N, that is a direct line into the Head On Radio Network studios. Agnes is there today, and she will get you on the air immediately. If you prefer to do that by phone, you can just pick up the phone and dial a phone number that'll get you directly into the studios as well. That number is area code 304-574-8178. That's 304-574-8178. If you'd prefer it not to come on the air, but at the same time you'd like to share your thoughts with me, I also like to use a little bit of my own discretion if it seems that this is something that our other listeners ought to hear and would benefit from. Then I'd like to share them with our listeners and kind of represent you, as it were, as if you called. And the reason I mention that is because I wouldn't present your thoughts with my interpretation on them. I would do the very best I could to present your thoughts as you presented them to me. And so if you'd like me to do that, you'd feel more comfortable doing that, then by all means, I invite you to send me an email. Email address is waobrien906@gmail.com. That's waobrien, O-B-R-I-E-N, 906@gmail.com. Yet another way that you can interact with the program, with me directly, is on our Facebook page. If you go to the homepage of Facebook, facebook.com, you'll see a search box at the top of the page, and if you type in the Virtual Center for Study of the Constitution, you will be onto our Facebook page, and you will see a number of postings as you scroll down. These are links to articles and some commentary that I've written on issues, and each of the postings is accompanied by a comment link, a comment box. And if you click on that, then you can make a direct comment back to me. The presumption, of course, is that the comment you make would be related to that particular posting, but it doesn't have to be. You can use the comment box on our Facebook page as an opportunity to send me an immediate message. And I'll do the very best I can to respond to you. And again, share your thoughts with our listeners if it seems appropriate. And if you tell me not to do that, of course, I wouldn't do it. But again, the goal is to kind of encourage as many interactive ways for us to communicate and interact with each other as we can. Not only me and you, but you and our other listeners as well. And so if you put your thoughts out there and give people an opportunity to react to them, chances are that you'll get some responses. And that's, again, that's really what we are after. I guess the way to launch into this reaction to the Putin-Trump press conference yesterday is to make the general comment that so many people are. I mean, this is one of those situations where you're glued to the television. It's disturbing. It's upsetting. It makes me quite nervous. It makes me quite angry. And my wife will say, just turn the darn thing off. And I go back to Watergate when I was in college and I was listening to the Watergate hearings on television. And my mom and dad used to see the same. I'd lived at home, and my mom and dad used to say the same thing to me. You're sitting there all night in the kitchen watching this. Why don't you go to bed? And I can remember saying to them, "I'll never say anything again like this again in my life. I mean, this is history being made right here, and I'm watching it." And that's kind of the way I felt last night. If I heard one person say that no president in the history of this nation has ever been associated with a performance like President Trump provided us yesterday, if one person said that, I've heard 15 or 20 say it. And I've heard all sorts of strong statements. I heard former CIA Director Brennan make the point that it was treasonous. John McCain fired off a letter, a public statement, which was incredible. Newt Gingrich, who's been an avid Trump supporter, made the comment that this was the biggest mistake that this president has made since he took office, and it needs to be rectified right now, immediately. So you get a rundown. Before we came on the air, I was taking one last run through some of the major publications, just checking to make sure that there wasn't a new headline, you know, that there really wasn't breaking news all of a sudden that I would go on the air and not be aware of. And I ran across this particular item in the Washington Post. It's an article that wasn't there earlier this morning when I went through it the first time, but it's there now. And what it is kind of a summation of comments from Republican members, mostly senators, not exclusively, but mostly senators, and their reactions to the president's performance yesterday. And it was so close to airtime that I didn't have any time to do anything else except leave it up on the computer screen so that I could share some of these with you when we got on the air. I didn't have time to print them off. I didn't have time to rank them or to highlight the ones that were the most substantive and the most significant. But I just want to share with you, because I think to get a flavor of this, and I think you all know what I'm talking about, but the thing about these comments that it seems to me make them relevant is the fact that most of them are from Republican lawmakers. So they aren't comments of Democrats, Schumer and the others, and we can obviously pretty much guess as to what their comments would be. But these are Republican comments. This is Senator Bob Corker, who's retiring at the end of his term in the state of Tennessee from the United States Senate. Corker said, "Putin gained a tremendous amount. Here he has been ostracized on the world stage. It was almost an approval, if you will. A public approval by the greatest nation on earth towards him. I would guess he's having caviar right now." Jeff Flake of Arizona, who's also retiring at the end of his term. And Jeff Flake has, since he announced his retirement, been very outspoken in his criticism of Donald Trump. Although I will say, very honestly, that what he's been saying has not been reflected in the way he votes. He's continued to vote straight down the line, if you will, in terms of supporting the president. Jeff Flake said, "I never thought I would see the day when our American president would stand on the stage with the Russian president and place blame on the United States for Russian aggression. This is shameful." Susan Collins of Maine, and of course we know how important she is because she's one of only a few Republican senators who have come out strongly for Roe v. Wade. And the implication is that if there were going to be any Republican defections in the Senate over the Kavanaugh nomination, one of those, many people feel, could be Susan Collins. Again, it would be a first because she tends to vote pretty much according to the party line as well, even though she frequently talks a good game prior to the vote and leaves some indication that she might not vote for the president's position on a particular issue, but so far she's fallen into line. Anyway, in her comments yesterday, she said, "The president's statements today in Helsinki demonstrate his continued refusal to accept the unanimous conclusions of U.S. intelligence leaders and the bipartisan findings of the Senate Intelligence Committee. This position is untenable and at odds with the forceful response this moment demands." Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, "If it were me, I'd check the soccer ball for listening devices and never allow it in the White House." I think I shared that one with you yesterday. Let me share a couple more. Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa. Chuck Grassley is chair of the Senate Judicial Committee, which will conduct the hearings on the Kavanaugh nomination. President Trump missed an opportunity to publicly press President Putin on whether he would agree to extradite the defendants to the United States to answer the allegations in court, unquote. I find that one a little bit interesting, because that's not, he does mention that the president passed up an opportunity. I don't think the amount of conversation and comment that yesterday has engendered would have happened if it was merely a missed opportunity. John McCain says, no prior president has ever abased himself more abjectly before a tyrant. And that's one sentence in a pretty profound, long, pretty powerful critical statement. Senator Portman, Bob Portman of Ohio, the president's comments in today's press conference were troubling. He failed to stand up to Vladimir Putin on some of the most critical security issues facing our country and our allies, unquote. Again, under the circumstances, I think that's a pretty mild criticism. It's a politically safe statement, it seems to me. Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, as Americans, we stand up for our interests and values abroad, but I fear today was a step backwards. Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska, who's also been outspoken in his criticism of President Trump. And he, as far as I know, is not a senator who's bent on leaving the Senate. Sasse says, this is bizarre and flat out wrong. The United States is not to blame. America wants a good relationship with the Russian people, but Vladimir Putin and his thugs are responsible for Soviet-style aggression. When the president plays these moral equivalence games, he gives Putin a propaganda win he desperately needs. And, of course, what he's referring to there about moral equivalency games is making reference to the president's comments that we bear a significant portion of the responsibility for the poor relations between the United States and the Russians. It's not only them. That we all do. And that is very, very reminiscent of the comments he made almost a year ago in Charlottesville over the demonstrations there that ended up with one death, if you remember, where he said in comments about white nationalists parading in Charlottesville, the president said there were good people on both sides, if you remember that. Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, the President of the United States' blindness to Putin's hostile acts against the U.S. and our allies, election meddling included, is very troubling. Senator Jerry Moran of Kansas, the President missed an opportunity to publicly condemn Russia for election interference or offer strong support for the NATO alliance. The problem with our relationship is not American actions, but rather Russia's duplicitous behavior. Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who along with Susan Collins of Maine, is one of the two Republican senators considered most likely to flip on the Supreme Court nomination vote. Sadly, President Trump did not defend America to the Russian president and for the world to see. Instead, what I saw today was not America first. It was simply a sad diminishment of our great nation. And again, it says it, but it doesn't say it in a way which bears too much political risk, it seems to me. Senator Dan Sullivan of Alaska, he's the other Alaskan senator. I disagree with the president's remarks following Helsinki summit. Specifically, do I believe the professional and patriotic men and women of our intelligence community, including the Director of National Intelligence, or a mafia regime leader like Putin? It's not even a close call. Paul Ryan, the president must appreciate that Russia is not our ally. Wow. That's Paul Ryan's statement. The president must appreciate that Russia is not our ally. In other words, the president made a mistake. And that's about as far as his comment goes. This is a comment from Representative Kathy McMorris Rogers, who's from the 5th Congressional District in the state of Washington. Russia is not a friend to the United States or our allies. There's no question that they meddled in our election, and all evidence points to Putin's direct involvement. In order to put America first, the president must hold Russia accountable for their adversarial actions and their continued efforts to undermine our democratic institutions. Representative Ed Royce of California, 39th District. I disagree with the president's comments. There's simply no comparing the actions of the United States and Vladimir Putin. And finally, Robert Goodlatte of Virginia, 6th Congressional District in Virginia. He was the chair of the Intelligence Committee that conducted the hearings last week of Strzok. He was the chair that battled so frequently, not only with Strzok, but with Democrats on his committee. U.S. intelligence agencies have confirmed Russia's actions, and the evidence is plentiful. Today's summit was an opportunity to forcefully address this growing threat directly with President Putin. I'm dismayed that we did not see that. And then, of course, there's the support of the president's performance from Rand Paul of Kentucky. I think it's a good idea to have engagement. I guess I don't quite understand all those people who have gone completely deranged criticizing the president, unquote. And there are other comments. There's one that I'd like to share with you because it kind of blew me away. And the reason I say that is because it was from the vice president. And I was very interested as to how the vice president would react to yesterday. And when I read this, I was quite disturbed. In a speech yesterday afternoon to Commerce Department employees, Vice President Pence conducted the Washington Post calls a rosy review of President Trump's, quote, historic trip abroad, unquote. And this is what Vice President Pence said about yesterday. The truth is, over the last week, the world saw once again that President Donald Trump stands without apology as leader of the free world. What the world saw, what the American people saw, is that President Donald Trump will always put the prosperity and security of America first. I hate to belabor the obvious, but I'm not sure which channel the vice president was watching, because I didn't see President Trump putting America first in very much that happened over the last 4 or 5 days. I think the president's, so far at least, lone tweet since he returned to Washington last night, it was interesting because as of 9 o'clock this morning, there had been no tweeting coming from the White House. And the media was waiting for it. And finally, before 10 a.m., the president did respond and responded in a way which to many seemed to indicate that he was beginning to get the message that this wasn't received very well. He didn't apologize. He didn't change his position any. But he did, and I don't have a copy of the tweet. I'm sure you'll see it. But what he did try to do was explain why he did what he did. And he talked about the fact that it's more important if you have an adversary to be communicating with the adversary than not. And that's Rand Paul's position as well. And I think philosophically, many of us believe that. But the fact of the matter is, the context, it seems to me, is significant as well. The president was at a press conference being televised all over the world. The world was watching. This probably wasn't the place for the president to conduct a 101 lesson in how best to conduct successful diplomacy. This was the wrong time and the wrong place and the wrong situation with the wrong person at the other podium. And I say all of that only from the perspective, if you try to give the president his due, even his justification for his performance doesn't hold up. And I'm not one that's ready to give him his due. Because I was absolutely appalled, and I think I mentioned this yesterday. I couldn't believe it. I mean, on the one hand, I could, but on the other hand, I couldn't. There are a couple of other things related to this that I wanted to share with you. I mentioned that I haven't heard a lot of people making much of them, at least so far. But they're little issues, side issues, that as you continue to read, as we get further and further away from the event, as we begin to gain a little bit more perspective, we also create a little bit more time for additional pieces of information to dribble out. And we begin to find out a little bit more about what went on than we knew initially. And I think, very honestly, that some of it is significant. I did pick up, about an hour before we came on the air today, the fact that the media, cable networks, were beginning to pick up a story that was featured on the front page of the Washington Post this morning. And it was the first story I've read that really began to reveal some inside information about what was going on with the president in the days and hours leading up to the press conference and to the meeting with Putin. And I'm, you know, some of this I think is particularly significant. One is that unnamed members of the administration, you know, an unnamed source, and you know, what these mean. But the fact of the matter is, people on the inside were saying that the president's advisors were not the architects of his performance yesterday. That on the contrary, they had recommended that the president take a totally different, much more rigid, much more negative stance against Putin. That the president push back, and that the president be somewhat hard on him. Furthermore, one source reported that they gave the president a 100-page primer on issues that he could use in confronting Vladimir Putin. Issues related to Crimea, Syria, Iran, a number of issues that would give the president some substantive information. And the recommendation from his staff was to use it and to use the opportunity to appear strong, to be strong before the world. And the reports are that the president's decision to do the very opposite was his own decision. It was made on the spur of the moment. He had the information. He had the recommendations. And without telling anybody, chose not to accept any of it. Not only that, but you'll remember, and I think this is significant as well, that once the visit to the UK was over, once the president got through after the press conference with Theresa May, as embarrassing as that was, he went to his golf estate in Scotland for 2 days, for the weekend, to prepare for the meeting with Putin on Monday. So theoretically, he had 2 days to prep himself and to become more familiar with some of these issues, Crimea and Ukraine and the rest of it. But the reports, again, unnamed, are that during his stay in Scotland, all he did was growl, principally at Mueller's release of the indictments on Friday, because he believed that Mueller's timing was such that it would serve as a political blow to him. It would make him look weak. And that he was complaining about that to his people. So in a sense, he was psychologically obsessed all weekend when he was supposed to be preparing, to the point when he went in there, he made his decision to do what he felt was best, based on the idea that he knows how to get along with people and cut deals. I thought that this was a particularly significant piece of information. One of the sources made the comment everyone around Trump was urging him to take a firm stance with Putin. A second person said his advisors covered matters from Russia's annexation of Crimea to its interference in the U.S. elections, but that, quote, Trump made a game time decision to handle the summit his way. And of course, when he, as you know, this was one of the things he said at the press conference. I think that the United States has been foolish, he said. I think we've all been foolish. We should have had this dialogue a long time ago. A long time, frankly, before I got to office. When I heard that, I was listening to the debate, obviously, so I remember that very well. Because that comment gave me pause. Because there's two ways to look at that. One way, I would suspect, is Trump's way. The way he most likely meant it. And the way he most likely meant it was, we got problems with Russia, but I didn't create them. They've been there for a long time. And the people whose responsibility it has been to address and solve these problems never did it. They just made it worse. So don't blame me. Blame Obama, blame George W. Bush, et cetera, et cetera, but not me. That's, I think, the way that most of the media is taking that particular comment. But to be realistic and honest about it, there is another way to look at that comment. And that is from the idealistic point of view, from a philosophical point of view. The idea that if you're going to patch things up and not make matters worse with an adversary, you've got to find a way to talk. You've got to be able to communicate. It's hard to argue with that philosophically. But under the circumstances, it seems to me, one has no choice but to argue with it. Again, not only because of the background, but because of the context, because of the nature of the situation, because he was standing beside Vladimir Putin, because the whole world was watching. And there's something else. One of these unnamed sources reported that I circled because I thought it was particularly relevant. And this gets into the president's personality. Into the president's narcissism. Into his egotism. This source said he loved the summit with Kim Jong-un. He thinks he can sit down eye to eye with these guys, flatter them, and make a deal, unquote. I would suggest that that comment probably says it all, because it explains the last minute game time decision the president made to not follow the advice of his advisors, to not follow the recommendations on the 100-page briefing paper that was given him in order that he could prepare for the summit. Rather, this is the president reacting from or acting from his own gut, his own sense of ability and skill, the art of the deal. He probably does believe that. And the fact that everybody knows he believes that means that he can be played like a violin. Most observers believe that Kim Jong-un played him. Most observers know for sure that Putin did. Because although we don't know a whole lot about Kim Jong-un, we know quite a bit about Vladimir Putin. We know his background. We know his skills. We know that he was a KGB officer. We know that he's a skilled interrogator. We know that he has all the skills that the president doesn't. And I'm pretty certain that this might be, more than anything else, the explanation for the performance yesterday. And the fact that it took the president so long, and to be realistic and do a little bit of speculating, it must have been awfully difficult for him to understand the level of criticism that he's received. I'm just guessing. This is just a guess on my part. But I'm guessing that it won't be long before the president's people schedule another campaign venture, campaign outing for the president. He needs his people. He needs a little bit of massaging because he's being wounded. The fact that he didn't send out a tweet until well after 9 a.m. this morning is not like him at all. The reports are, in this particular piece in the Post, that on the way back from Helsinki in the plane, he was huddled with his staff as they tried to figure out a strategy to counter the negative comments that were coming their way from all over the world, including from people that they didn't expect them from. There's no question that yesterday's performance with Putin constitutes an exclamation point for the entire weekend. Somehow the president found it easy to deal with Putin his way. And he took on NATO and took on the nation's allies and may have created a series of diplomatic and economic challenges that haven't yet begun to hit the nation full force. The tariff issues are about to be felt. The tax cut is beginning to be appreciated for what it was and what it was not. People are beginning to realize that they're paying 60 cents a gallon more for gasoline than they were a year ago. And they're beginning to realize that a lot of it is reaction to President Trump's economic policies is tariffs and the restrictive restrictions that he's put on the Soviets and the Iranians and the rest of it. It's already happening that many of our traditional allies have begun to seek alliances and treaties with other peoples in order to find alternatives to the United States. I saw a reference this morning to the fact that the European Union has been in direct contact not only with China, but with nations of Latin America looking for free trade opportunities to find ways to repair the trade damage that the president has inflicted upon those nations. I thought it was very interesting in the lead up to the press conference yesterday with President Putin, that reports came out. I didn't know this, and I had no reason to, but I didn't. And that is the very positive relationships that Russia has developed with Saudi Arabia. And traditionally, our relationship with Saudi Arabia in that part of the world has been critically important. For one thing, access to oil, OPEC oil. Also, Putin has developed a very solid relationship with Netanyahu of Israel. So basically, diplomatic things are happening in the world, which clearly are the result of some of the things that this president has initiated. And I think perspective-wise, it's important to realize that he's only been in office 18 months. We have not even reached the halfway point of his presidency. And there's serious talk of a second term. And I've heard people say the nation might be able to withstand 4 years of Donald Trump. But many people are saying we could never do it for eight. So here we are. I apologize for somebody's leaving a message on the phone, and I apologize. So anyway, there we are, and I think this is the reaction. I think the reaction is going to continue to happen in coming days. As I mentioned, we won't be doing a live program tomorrow, so we have 5 or 6 days to kind of watch the fallout from this past 4 or 5 days of diplomatic activity. It is my guess that the president needs a rally of his people, and he needs it bad, and it's probably going to happen. I'm just guessing that. Received kind of a backhanded criticism from Mitch McConnell. But when I read the statement from Paul Ryan, not much of a criticism at all from Paul Ryan, other than to deny the president's premise by suggesting that Russia is not our ally. It's an adversary. So there we are. And here we are. Actually, we've just about reached the top of the first hour. I was going to say maybe we ought to take our break a little bit early, and as it turns out, we're just going to be kind of right on time. So again, you're listening to the Virtual Center for Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility. We're going to pause for a 4 or 5 minute break. Then we'll be right back with our second hour. And I'd like to begin our second hour by taking a look at President Carter's crisis of conscience, a crisis of confidence speech from 39 years ago. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Constitution and Civic Responsibility. Here's your host, Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Thank you, Agnes, and I enjoyed Along Came Betty. What a wonderful piece of music. Thank you. Welcome to our second hour on this Tuesday edition of the Virtual Center for Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility. I kind of had the feeling at the end of the hour when we started our break, it just kind of flashed through my mind that I think the situation yesterday has beat me down. I was actually depressing myself. I didn't mean to depress you all, and I apologize for that if I did it. But again, you get into this stuff, and it just kind of works on your head a little bit, and I think a little bit of it did on me, and I found myself kind of slowing down a little bit and saying, any more of this, et cetera. And then during the break, it dawned on me that there was one additional issue associated with the Helsinki situation, President Trump's performance and all the rest of it, that I wanted to bring to your attention, or at least call attention to, because some of you probably already know about it. And I totally forgot and didn't get to it. And I could have, because it would have been very appropriate right at the end of the first hour. But I think maybe we can begin and take 5 or 10 minutes in this hour and kind of put that issue to rest as well. Again, let me invite you to feel comfortable to call in and share your thoughts with us on this issue, which is so important. Everybody has an opinion on this one. We would love to hear yours. If you would like to call in, you can call directly into the studio by picking up your phone and dialing 304-574-8178. That's 304-574-8178. Or on Skype, you can type in Bob Kincaid Horn, and that'll get you into the studios as well. In either situation, Agnes will get you on the line immediately, and you'll be on the air. Or you can put your thoughts in an email and send them to me at my email address, which is waobrien906@gmail.com. That's waobrien, O-B-R-I-E-N, 906@gmail.com. Or on our Facebook page. You can go to one of the postings and click on one of the comment buttons and make a comment on the posting itself, or if you prefer, on an issue that you would like to share with me and potentially with our other listeners as well. So again, there are a number of different ways that you can get your thoughts into the hopper, so to speak, and hopefully we can get them on the air. I wanted to go back a minute to the issue of the Putin-Trump news conference. And the two things. One, minor. Not minor, but it'd be minor in terms of the time it takes. The other one would require a little bit of attention. The first one, the quick one, let me make a point, because I think it's there. I think everybody realizes it. But sometimes we tend to overlook it. Without a doubt, everybody's reaction to yesterday is focused on the news conference held at the end of the two-hour-plus meeting that President Trump and Putin held by themselves. And of course, that makes perfect sense, because the only thing we had privy to, the only thing we were witness to, was their performance behind the microphones in responding to the media's questions. I don't think that we can afford to ignore the fact that these two men had more than 2 hours of private conversation before that news conference. And of course, the speculation is that we'll probably never know exactly what was said in those 2 hours. Because in both cases, we're dealing with people who regularly lie. And the fact that they are human beings suggests that when they do report on what they talked about, it's going to put their own personal spin on it. So it's going to be their reading of what was said in that room. Brennan, former CIA director Brennan, made the comment that he would bet money that the Russians recorded the two-hour session. It's kind of interesting. Somebody said, "Do you think we might have as well?" And he said, I wouldn't get into that. But the fact of the matter is, he said it would be out of character to have a meeting like that and not have the Russians have a recording of it. So what we find out about it might come ultimately from the Russians. But the fact of the matter is, what they talked about in those 2 hours is important, even though we don't know what it is. I do think that we can speculate a little bit based on the performance we saw after the two-hour meeting ended. And if it was more of what we saw, then it's probably not pretty from our perspective. But we can't know this, so there's no reason to do any more with it than that. But all I wanted to do was make reference to the fact, you know, let's not forget that there was a two-hour session that these two men held before the 46-minute press conference. That's the first thing. The second thing, and I don't know how this slipped my mind totally, after the press conference ended yesterday, Fox News, because of its preferred position and standing with the White House, was granted interviews with both Trump and Putin. And without even guessing, one would expect that President Trump's appearance with Sean Hannity would be pretty predictable, because there's no bigger fan of the president's than Sean Hannity. And from what I picked up, and I didn't watch it, but from what I picked up about it, Hannity just gave the president more airtime to make the points he was making during the press conference itself. But it's the other Fox News interview that I wanted to call attention to. And that's a 30-minute interview with Putin conducted by Chris Wallace. I made the comment, I believe yesterday, that I've always had a fondness for Chris Wallace, probably because I was so fond of his dad. But I always felt that Chris Wallace was a competent journalist. Turns out that the reports of the interview, which was aired on Fox, that he had with Putin, basically asked many of the tough questions that critics wish President Trump had confronted Putin with. Into the election hacking, issues related to that, let me get my notes here. the election hacking issue, and a comment that an issue that I had heard about, but I hadn't read anything about until now. And that's the presumed threat of nuking Florida that came up in a video that that Putin's people released. Because when you watch it, you see that it's the east coast of Florida, and of course represented there are nuclear strikes. Agnes had mentioned that to me yesterday before we went on the air, and I hadn't seen anything about it. And what I knew about it was what she mentioned. Chris Wallace raised it with Putin. So in a sense, Chris Wallace did what most people hoped President Trump would do. And, in my mind, he kind of held up the family tradition, if you will, that he inherited from his dad. But there's a couple of things in this particular exchange with Chris Wallace that I found particularly notable and interesting. According to this report, which is in Politico, very early into the interview, just a few minutes in, Wallace brought up the issue of Russian interference in the 2016 election and produced a copy of the indictment that Robert Mueller had issued on Friday, accusing the 12 Russian intelligence operatives of hacking Democratic targets, of hacking Podesta's emails and Hillary Clinton's emails and all the rest of it. According to this write-up in Politico, Putin started to laugh as Wallace described the allegations. Wallace said at that point, "You smile, Mr. President. Let me finish." Quote, "You say that these units were involved in hacking into Democratic Party computers, stealing information, and spreading it to the world to try to disrupt an election. And he handed the indictment to Putin. According to the report, Putin paused, motioned for Wallace to put the document on the table between them. And then Putin took up the question of hacking Democratic computers. And ended up pretty much defending the hacking, because the information that came out of it was real information. It was the truth. Putin said the idea was about hacking an email account of a Democratic candidate. Was it some rigging of facts? Was it forgery of facts? That's the important thing that I'm trying to point, that I'm trying to make, Putin said. Was this any false information being planted? No, it wasn't, Putin said. He said that the hackers entered a certain, and this is important, entered a certain email account, and there was information about manipulations conducted within the Democratic Party to incline the process in favor of one candidate, unquote. That obviously refers to inside Democratic Party efforts to swing the election in favor of Hillary Clinton rather than Bernie Sanders, to swing the primaries. Wallace and Putin then get into an argument because Putin kept accusing Wallace of interrupting him and not letting him finish his answer. Wallace said, quote, "You're indicating that they stole real money, not counterfeit money," Wallace said. "Are you saying it's okay because the facts they took from the DNC, from John Podesta, it was their real emails, so it's okay to hack and spread information out and interfere with the election?" Unquote. In response to Wallace, Putin dodged. He reiterated his point and then asked Wallace to be patient. "If you don't like my answer," Putin said, "you can give it to me straight away and I'll just keep quiet," Putin said. "If you want Americans to listen to my opinion, would you please wait a little bit?" Wallace then made reference to the press conference and to the fact that President Trump spent more time, this is a quote from Wallace, spent more time criticizing the Democrats and asking about the Democratic server than he did criticizing Russia and asking about the GRU. And then he turned to Putin and said, "Do you have what he called compromise, compromising information on President Trump? Or is it that as a skilled politician and former KGB officer, you know how to play him? You use phrases like fake news and deep state." At that point, Putin responded the following about President Trump. He said, "I don't want to insult President Trump when I say this, and I may come as rude. But before he announced that he would run for the presidency, he was of no interest to us. He was a rich person, but well, there are plenty of rich persons in the United States. He was in the construction business. He organized beauty pageants. But no, it would never occur to anyone that he would ever think of running for president." Funnily enough, this was one of the few points, and this is a write-up of the article from Politico. This was one of the few points where Putin and Trump disagreed. Trump said, "You know, many years ago, I was there, 12, 13, 14 years ago. There were many business people there, true." He said, "In all fairness, I was a very successful businessman." In other words, even though there were 500 businessmen in Moscow at the time, chances are he would have known me because I was one of the most successful ones. But he said, "I was one of a lot of people. And one thing you know, if they had it, it would have been out." And then the last issue that Wallace dealt with in this interview with Putin was on the killing of opponents, of political opponents, on those political opponents of Putin who end up dead. And Putin's response to Wallace was to point out the assassinations of John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King, and point out that in every society there are political opponents. And Wallace responded, but here that we, you know, they don't all end up dead. And effectively, that was pretty much the end of the interview. The reason I mention it is because when pressed, Putin admitted the hacking of Democratic headquarters. He also confirmed that the leadership of the Democratic Party was stacking the deck against Bernie Sanders and in favor of Hillary Clinton. And in this interview with Wallace, President Putin made the point that instead of criticizing me, you ought to be getting out to the people of the country how the election was being manipulated against their best interests. You know, there's something to that. We had all heard stories about the degree to which the Democratic Party was determined to deny the nomination to Bernie Sanders for fear that while his following was passionate, it wasn't big enough to win the election. I mentioned here on this program the fact that when West Virginia cast its 32 votes at the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia, those votes were cast for Hillary Clinton. When in fact, the reality is that Bernie Sanders won the Democratic Convention in West Virginia. But the leadership of the Democratic Party in West Virginia on national television wanted to make it look like West Virginia was behind a winner, which was presumed to be Hillary Clinton. So they changed the results of the election here in West Virginia. I think it's important to keep a lot of these things in mind and to try to keep some perspective on the kinds of things that are happening, because they're extremely important. As we gear up for this November's off-year election in 2018, we hear conflicting reports and predictions. We hear about the likelihood of a blue wave, where there's so much sentiment against Trump that Democrats are going to pick up so many seats that they might actually take back the House of Representatives. And even though the division, the split in the Senate is close, most of the Senate candidates running for election this fall are Democratic incumbents. So it's going to be much easier for Democrats to lose seats in the Senate than win them. But there are also other predictions, and of course, President Trump's predicting this all the time, is that his victory in 2018 is going to be even more solid than his victory in 2016. In other words, that his supporters are going to strengthen Republican majorities in both houses. And that is all involved in predicting the strength of the president's base and the degree to which that they can anticipate that his base will come out and vote, and whether Democrats will come out as well. The traditional idea that the bigger the turnout, the better it looks for Democrats, is probably going to be more real this time around than ever before. But the reality is that whichever one of these things happens to play out in November, we have to realize that we're still dealing with politics here, and it ain't pretty. Making sausage isn't a pretty process. And so I think while we load up our criticism of President Trump and his performances, we have to realize that the Democratic Party does not, you know, is not free of legitimate criticism as well. I think that's important to keep in mind and not lose that perspective. With this kind of a background, let me go to the issue that I mentioned, and that is the speech by President Carter 39 years ago this past Sunday on July 15th, 1979. And it was a message to the nation, and of course, the situation in the nation was dire. Inflation was rampant, gasoline prices were out the top, interest rates, everything. And the situation was extremely bad. And President Carter was prepared to address the nation. But before he did, he believed that it was time to not get out there and tell people what was wrong with the nation, but rather give the nation an opportunity to tell him what they thought was wrong with it. He said, "I invited to Camp David from almost every segment of our society, business, labor, teachers, preachers, governors, mayors, private citizens. Then I left Camp David to listen to other Americans, men and women just like you. For 10 days, he collected information before he made this speech. And he shared, I apologize for the phone in the background. He shared some of the comments that some of the people made to him. I'll read a few of them to you. "Mr. President, you're not leading this nation, you're just managing the government." Another statement, "You don't see the people enough anymore. Some of your cabinet members don't seem loyal. There's not enough discipline among your disciples. Don't talk to us about politics or the mechanics of government, but about an understanding of our common good. Mr. President, we're in trouble. Talk to us about blood, sweat, and tears. Mr. President, if you lead, we'll follow." And those are the kinds of comments that the president was getting. He said, "These 10 days confirm my belief." This is all part of his speech on television. "These 10 days confirm my belief in the decency and strength and wisdom of the American people. But it also bore out some of my longstanding concerns about our nation's underlying problems." And this begins the part of the speech that I particularly wanted to focus on today. President Carter said the following, "I know, of course, being president, that government actions and legislation can be very important. That's why I've worked hard to put my campaign promises into law. And I have to admit, with just mixed success. But after listening to the American people, I've been so reminded again that all the legislation in the world can't fix what's wrong with America. So I want to speak to you first tonight about a subject even more serious than energy or inflation. I want to talk to you right now about a fundamental threat to American democracy. I don't mean our political and civil liberties." It seems like I'm popular today. That's the third time the phones rang during our program. I don't mean our political and civil liberties, President Carter said. "They will endure. And I do not refer to the outward strength of America, a nation that is at peace tonight everywhere in the world, with unmatched economic power and military might." President Carter said, "The threat is nearly invisible in ordinary ways. It is a crisis of confidence." It is a crisis of confidence. It is a crisis that strikes at the very heart and soul and spirit of our national will. We can see this crisis in the growing doubt about the meaning of our own lives and the loss of a unity of purpose for our nation. The erosion of our confidence in the future is threatening to destroy the social and the political fabric of America. The confidence that we've always had as a people is not simply some romantic dream or a proverb in a dusty book that we read just on the 4th of July. It's the idea which founded our nation and has guided our development as a people. Confidence in the future has supported everything else. Public institutions and private enterprise, our own families, the very Constitution of the United States. Confidence has defined our course and has served as a link between generations. We've always believed in something called progress. We've always had a faith that the days of our children would be better than our own. Let me pause there for a moment, because I think what the president was speaking to 39 years ago is much more a problem today than it was even then. Because his president, even he admitted then, that we were at peace in the world, and that the military and economic strength of this nation was unchallenged and unparalleled. So the problems that he focuses on are domestic ones, are within the American country, the nation itself. I think what we've been talking about yesterday and today is a situation which has gotten a lot worse than the one that prompted President Carter to deliver this speech about a crisis in confidence. Because this nation lost it. There's no question that it's that loss which caused people to turn to this particular president, because they really believed that they had nowhere to go but up. It couldn't get any worse. As President Trump himself said during his campaign more than once, to especially African-American audiences, what the hell do you have to worry about? Give me a shot. It can't be any worse than it is now. We have allowed our domestic situation to get worse. We have created a situation where there are so many in this country that have become dependent on government and government services that it's frightening. The nation's faith in free enterprise is failing. It's failing because it's not working for too many of our people. Not only that, but for those few who are doing extremely well in this society, they have, to quote the Stephen Brill article we looked at the other day, they have made it, and they've pulled up the ladder so nobody else can make it, so they can keep whatever there is for themselves by keeping the rest of us out. So if there was a crisis of confidence in this country 39 years ago, I would suggest that it's a lot worse today Not only that, but the assumption that we could go nowhere but up was obviously wrong, given the performance, first in Brussels, then in the UK, and then in Helsinki the last 3 or 4 days. It could get worse. It is getting worse. It's time for action. I believe President Carter's message continues to be important because the situation doesn't seem to be improving. Let me go back to President Carter. Our people are losing that faith, not only in government itself, but in the ability as citizens to serve as the ultimate rulers and shapers of our democracy. As a people, we know our past and we're proud of it. Our progress has been part of the living history of America, even the world. We always believed that we were part of a great movement of humanity itself called democracy, involved in the search for freedom. And that belief has always strengthened us in our purpose. But just as we're losing our confidence in the future, we're also beginning to close the door on our past. In a nation that was proud of hard work, strong families, close-knit communities, and a faith in God, too many of us now tend to worship self-indulgence and consumption. Human identity is no longer defined by what one does, by what one owns. I messed that up pretty good, didn't I? Human identity is no longer defined by what one does, but by what one owns. But we've discovered that owning things and consuming things does not satisfy our longing for meaning. We've learned that piling up material goods cannot fill the emptiness of lives, which have no confidence or purpose. The symptoms of this crisis of the American spirit are all around us. For the first time in the history of our country, a majority of our people believe that the next 5 years will be worse than the last 5 years. Two-thirds of our people do not even vote. The productivity of American workers is actually dropping. The willingness of Americans to save for the future has fallen below that of all other people in the Western world. There's a growing disrespect for government, for churches, for schools, the news media, and other institutions. This is not a message of happiness and reassurance, but it's the truth. And it's a warning. And then the president goes into a little bit of the history and explains that these things didn't happen all of a sudden overnight. Ironically, in our situation, relatively speaking, it happened almost overnight. The situation was declining and deteriorating, and it created opportunity. And President Trump was able to take advantage of that opportunity, despite predictions to the contrary from almost every knowledgeable, reputable source. I really believe that President Carter was speaking from his heart when he said that. I was particularly struck by the line about not only losing confidence in the future, but closing the door to our past. Losing touch with what made this nation great. It hasn't improved since President Carter issued those words to the nation in 1979. In fact, it's even worse. We're raising questions now about the safety net. There are serious questions as to whether, in fact, we even ought to have a safety net. These changes are not just happening in Washington, they're happening all over the country, in Republican-controlled legislatures around the country. State after state is imposing work requirements for all of those people that get any kind of assistance from any particular agency of government. The implication being that the people who are getting assistance are just lazy and won't work. When the data tells us that most of the people that are in need of assistance do work. Work several jobs and are still struggling. That is when some people are making so much. Last night, like many people, I'm guessing, I watched a little bit of the festivities associated with the All-Star game in Washington. The game itself is tonight. But last night they had the home run hitting contest. And of course, the most appropriate winner would be Bryce Harper, who plays for the Washington Nationals. And he won the home run hitting contest. And he's a little bit of a ham bone. In fact, he's quite a bit of a ham bone. And that's a little bit strange in Major League Baseball. Most of the ham bones, most of the prima donnas, tend to be in the other sports, basketball especially. The basketball season is over. It's been over for a bit. But if you watch the talk shows, the sports talk shows, it's like the season never ended. Because LeBron James is a source of revenue that seemingly keeps on giving. He's moving to the big market in Los Angeles. With an absolutely incredible contract. Why do I mention this? Because the talk is that Bryce Harper is in line for a similar contract with the Washington Nationals. The estimates are that the conversation is revolving around a 10-year contract for something in the neighborhood of $300 million. That would be the second highest contract in professional baseball history. The highest one, of course, was the Giancarlo Stanton contract that the Yankees signed to lure him from the Miami. From Miami. $300 million. When I heard conversations about this, I was absolutely stunned. First of all, I wondered how anybody could possibly spend $300 million. $1,000. But then I wondered also what you would have to do to earn $300 million. One of the things I heard, for example, was that Bryce Harper's batting average is 214. 214. It used to be that if you were below 250, your status as a major leaguer was in question. And what the conversation was focusing on is, well, the game's changed because of the home run and the hitting contest and the fact that the priority issue for players is to put people in the seats to draw crowds. And that's where Bryce Harper shines. He's got a personality. He's got an ego. He puts butts in the seats. I had just finished rereading President Carter's speech from 1979. And I was thinking about the applicability of that speech to today's world, the world of Donald Trump. And I was thinking about what's happening to the safety net. I was thinking about the fact that Paul Krugman wrote an article in this morning's New York Times about the Republicans' war against the poor and the ideological ideological priorities and prejudices of the political leadership in Washington today. And the fact that they are still driven by assumptions about poor people that many people realize were unfounded 50 years ago. That they're welfare queens. That everybody's out to beat the system. That nobody wants to work. I live in West Virginia, in southern West Virginia. There aren't any good jobs here. There are jobs. This is an employer's paradise. Now that the state is a right-to-work state. The state Supreme Court has been reformed. The justice system has been reformed. The courts are not nearly as likely to find for the plaintiff as they used to be. Worker rights are taking a tremendous beating here. They've been taking a beating in other places even longer. The consumptive society, consumption society that Jimmy Carter speaks of is real. And you can see it even here. The area's best restaurants are full. Sometimes you wonder, where do people who can't find jobs find the revenue to go out and eat dinner at any of these places? The fact of the matter is there is money here, but the majority of people aren't making it. And not only aren't they making it, but they're being saddled with all of these stereotypes about unwillingness to work and all the rest of it. And then in the midst of all of this, I hear conversation about Bryce Harper and the likelihood of a $300 million contract. And I'm thinking something's wrong. Something's woefully wrong. And I think back to Jimmy Carter's statement in his speech about closing the door of the past. He mentioned in that speech, if you'll remember, that Americans know their past. I would argue that that's increasingly untrue. The reason that events are moving in the direction they're moving is because so many American citizens are so gullible and so manipulable. Don't know their past. They believe what they're being told by people with an agenda. And votes are being cast by people whose loyalty and support is being bought with political contributions, campaign contributions, unlimited campaign contributions as a result of Citizens United. So I think President Carter's speech from 39 years ago is more pertinent, more relevant today than it ever was. I think it would do all of us well every once in a while to go back and reread it. I think it's vintage Jimmy Carter. And I think the more time we can spend reading vintage somebody else in today's world, we'll be better off. We've only got a couple of minutes left in our program today. It's 58 minutes after the hour, so we've got about 2 minutes left. As I mentioned, we will not be doing a live program tomorrow. So this is the last program we'll have live until the first of next week. I want to take this opportunity to thank you once again for your continued support of the program and your support of Bob and Agnes and the folks at Head On who bring programs like this to you. Please remain aware. I think the nation may be on the cusp of some serious action. I've thought so in the past. I think so once again. People that would never say it are now advocating that the people must speak en masse. I pray that they will. For Bob and Agnes and myself, Bill O'Brien here at the Virtual Center, I want to thank you for your continued support. I hope you have a wonderful Tuesday, rest of this Tuesday, and that you have a wonderful rest of the week. All things working out, Lord willing, we'll be back together on Monday. This is Bill O'Brien. Thank you so very, very much for your continued support. I really do appreciate it. Thank you.